Welcome to Savor. I'm Danielle Beck Ellsworth, a licensed marriage and family therapist.
And I'm Kelly Hines, a registered dietitian.
It's getting pretty hot out there around the United States, getting close to summer. And how many of you are starting to feel the pressure to get into that bikini body or have the abs to go with those swim trunks? It's that time of year where there's more and more talk about dieting and changing your body so you have the right to be out in public in a swimsuit.
Yeah, definitely. And so probably a lot of you are heading on to diets and looking up different things online. And so today we're going to do the first installment in our series about dieting. So we'll be taking a look at the history of dieting in our culture and really also the history of the scale, if anybody ever thought about where that came from. Different sorts of controls over our body that are, you know, external messages, possibly things that feminist perspectives would look at with dieting. And then taking a look at all those diet shows that are so popular on television, you know, The Biggest Loser, Dr. Oz. And then finally talking about, you know, if diets really work, then why do weight loss clubs offer lifetime memberships?
Yeah, that is very, very telling. But, you know, they really, you know, do invest, I'm sure, a lot of money in marketing and drawing in that consumer because so many people do, you know, try these diets and believe, you know, the claims that are being put out there because they really are selling much more than a diet. They're selling a new life for people. A lot of times the diets are associated with success and love and your dreams coming true and, you know, finally body acceptance. But unfortunately, that's not what majority of people actually end up getting from the diet.
And so many people kind of put their lives on hold. You know, when I lose weight, when I can fit into that dress, then I'll take that vacation or then I'll start dating or, you know, anything instead of living in the moment.
Right.
Yeah. So, Danielle, you have this really amazing book that I had never seen before called The Body Project. And it's an intimate history of American girls by Brumberg. And it kind of goes into the history of diets and some really fascinating information in there. So,
yeah, it talks about dieting. It also reviews the pressure on young girls to have perfect skin, and also pressure on them as their body's changing through puberty and they're starting to menstruate, and pressures to, you know, maintain virginity, like, you know, all of these things that are coming up around adolescence for young girls, but especially the body pressure. I mean, well, it's all about kind of the body in some way, but the shape of the body comes up a lot. And it does cover how these pressures have changed over time. And they even, it even in the middle of the book, it has all these great pictures of old ads and old scales at carnivals, and so just, you know, things that have we kind of forget and have been lost over time. But the scale wasn't always in everybody's home bathroom.
Yeah, definitely. So, Danielle, what do you know about the history of dieting? Because, I mean, if you think back on it, diets haven't always been around. So, you know, there definitely was a time in our life where we didn't have enough food, right? And now there has become an abundance of food. Right. But people used to have to put a lot more effort into their food. They were growing their food. They were trying to survive. And, you know, in many cultures over history, a larger frame, more fat on the body, that was very desired. And it indicated that you had enough food, you had enough money for food. But at some point, there was this shift from, you know, we need to have enough food and that's a good thing, to how can we, you know, how can we be as little as possible?
Yes. Well, there's, I mean, there's been so many factors that have influenced it. But if we look at, you know, the 1920s and, you know, even before then, the movement, women's suffrage movement, we're seeing women getting more of a voice, and finally in 1920 getting the right to vote. And at the same time, a year later, it is the first Miss America contest. And also early 1920s, just beauty pageants in general start to get more popular and prevalent. So there's always been, I would say, a tension on a female form. We see that throughout history with corsets and just different obligations that women would have to go through to maintain a particular type of look, depending on the culture and the time period. But the act of the diet, of restricting to lose weight or change the shape, really starts to gaining momentum 1920s, 1930s, 1940s. Not anywhere near where we are today. I mean, it's drastically different today, but it's just starting that people are really feeling they can, change the way they look. They don't have to kind of accept exactly, how they were born. And there's even just that added piece of beauty being this external feature, right? And that by changing the body and looking a certain way, then you can be, beautiful. So through the competitions, through people talking more about appearance, we do start to see that shift. Now, it's not popular, I would say, at this period of time yet. It might even be seen as rebellious to do a diet, or just kind of this temporary fashionable game that, young girls would be doing. Not where we see it today, where it's like yo-yo dieting on and off, on and off, on and off. It also, in this time period, it really isn't much about health. Today I think it's been really confused with health, but earlier it's still much more about looking a certain way and the shape of it all. Also, another really great book, The Religion of Thinness, by Michelle Lelwicka, she talks about also dieting, the history of dieting, and her take on it comes from ideas around morality. And so she goes into how having control over the body is this symbol of control, and kind of purity, and being, even connecting it way back to earlier 1600s when, we hear about Catherine, St. Catherine, and her whole piece of, being more holy because she wasn't eating, not really a diet there, but restricting kind of early on. But then kind of seeing that pattern over time where now here we are, early 1900s, where overeating is seen as gluttonous, and so as a sinful type of behavior. So doing the opposite, restraining, is seen as more kind of holy and pure, and that's a good girl kind of idea.
Do you think that that goes along with like fasting in some religions then? Would that be the same sort of thing? A lot of religions have a day of fast, or if you're trying to really get closer with the Lord, you'll have a fasting period or something like that. Would that be?
Yes. Yeah. And that's kind of what with Catherine of, Siena, she was saying that with her belief system, that it was her way of getting closer to God. And it's not really comparable to anorexia or diet restricting that we see now, but there's what's kind of carried over is that you do see the association with restricting as a form of being in control. And if you're in control, then you're somehow like a good person, and you have good morals, and you're not, overtaken by the urge to, consume large amounts of food, things like that. So in the, early 1900s, it's no longer about your relationship with a higher power. In a general sense, of course, people are still doing that today, but the theme of the general population that we're talking about, it's just kind of these subtleties that still have lingered, that there's something positive associated with restricting. It connects back to willpower, and you can say no to temptation, right? And we even see that in advertising today still. I mean, they make those connections between sin and temptation and guilt. That still goes on.
Yeah. Yes. Killing Us Softly. If anybody ever gets the chance to look up Jean Kilbourne, she has a series, Killing Us Softly, mm-hmm. and she takes a look at all of the advertising messages that exactly have to do with that.
Yeah.
The being good and sin and fat right. and skinny and things like yeah. that. There's so many resources. We right. should list those on our website because okay. Religion of Thinness and Jean Kilbourne yeah. and this book.
Yeah.
We'll definitely put those up there for you.
Okay. So at the same time, you know, with more attention on, you know, rating female beauty in these competitions, we're also seeing the scale pop up. Do you want to talk a little bit about the that old scale?
Sure. So when I looked up a little bit about the history of the bathroom scale, because I was thinking there definitely was a time in our lives where people were not stepping on a scale to figure out, you know, what they were in life. Mm-hmm. And so what I found out was that the first coin-operated scale came to the U.S. in 1885. And it was made in Germany back then. And it wasn't until 1889 that the National Scale Company started making coin-operated scales in the United States. And it was over 200 pounds. And it was sort of like a vending machine type of thing that you would have to pay to get your weight. And a lot of times they would be at fairs or drugstores or things like that. But it definitely wasn't, you know, a common household mm-hmm. item.
It almost sounds like the blood pressure cups that we have mm-hmm. now. Like mm-hmm. most homes don't have their own device for taking their blood pressure. But you can go down to like Long's and right. the drugstore and they right. have it right there by the pharmacy, and uh-huh. you can get your blood pressure.
Right. And who knows what it was back then. I mean, maybe it was just fun for people because mm-hmm. it was like new information, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, all of a sudden, you didn't even probably know how much you weighed or what weight was, and now all of a sudden, you could just jump on a scale and figure it out. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like getting your fortune or something yeah. like that. And so then in the 1920s and 1930s, though, the Peerless Scale Company started manufacturing scales, and they became much, much, much more popular. And so Janine Fraser, who wrote this piece I was looking at, said, you know, that it was in the middle of the Depression, and even though they couldn't have money for anything else, they had money, like a penny, that they could use to weigh themselves. So they were pretty popular at that point in time. And there were 750 scales in the U.S. by the mid-1930s. Mm-hmm. And then it wasn't until the 1940s where they had enough advances in technology that people could bring them into the home. Mm-hmm. And I think that's interesting because I've also read books and articles before about women really entering the workforce, mm-hmm. and that was around the time of the World War, you know, when women had to go into the workforce. Mm-hmm. But then that's also the same time that the scale came into the home and ads mm-hmm. started really targeting women, where ads used to be, you know, don't let anybody call you skinny, they started turning mm-hmm. more into, you could change yourself, you could lose weight, you could look like that. And it mm-hmm. happened to be about the same time. So we haven't even had scales around for 100 years. I mean, that's only true. Been yeah. 70 years that mm-hmm. we've had scales in our homes. Mm-hmm. And now, I mean, there are people who absolutely can't get through a day without weighing themselves. They yeah. weigh every single morning. And these are people who don't even have eating mm-hmm. disorders.
Right.
They weigh in the morning. They weigh at mm-hmm. night. They record it. Mm-hmm. It's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And they only came around 70 years ago. So mm-hmm. how did people measure themselves and their health mm-hmm. before then? What was happening?
They just went to the doctor. Or, I mean, actually, I mean, weight wasn't so much associated with health back mm-hmm. then. So it wasn't mm-hmm. this huge factor that people felt pressure to monitor on their own.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Definitely. Yeah. So there's our bathroom scale.
I was just thinking it'd be fascinating if our obsession had not been about weight, but maybe had been about like body temperature, mm. you know, because a lot of people have, you know, thermometers at home. Uh-huh. And of course, you know, when our body temperature gets super, super high, you know, it can be dangerous. But, you know, it could be something that people were like, I want to be 98.7, you uh-huh. know, and they would like do behaviors to be able to stay within like that perfect range because it had meaning. And, mm-hmm. you know, we could have right. been obsessed about something else.
Right.
But, it, you know, it happened to be weight that got all this meaning,
yeah.
you know. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. well, and it's like, isn't that phrenology. I mean, didn't people use, I'm not sure what that is, but isn't that where they used to look at the size of people's head or the shapes of people's head or something like that? And it supposedly was telling them.
Yeah, it was the bumps on their heads. Uh-huh. And depending on the size of the bumps, it could tell you like if the person was aggressive or that you know, just different personality traits and you know, prone to depression, things like that. And eventually they, you know, realized there was no connection between bumps on your head and your personality. But, you know, I actually, you know, for our listeners, Kelly was just looking at my own phrenology head ceramic figurine I have in my office. And I hold on to that and I keep that as a reminder of really how wrong, you know, we could be sometimes, you know, about something, and to really kind of keep an open mind and open to new ideas and look for strong evidence-based approaches, because it wasn't really well researched, because it's easy to kind of get, you know, swept away with something like this, that it's like, oh, this is, you know, could tell the fortune or tell the personality, because it's easy. And I think that's what we see with BMI. Like, it's like, easy, so it must be true. But
and then not only was phrenology saying, okay, this is this information, and so now we can tell everything about this person, we're kind of doing that with weight too. So you're skinny, which means you are successful, driven, motivated, you know, self-controlled, and you're
healthy.
Fat. Yeah, and you're fat, so you're lazy, slob, no good at work, you know, unhealthy, etc. So you're just making all of these judgments based on one number. Absolutely.
So it is pretty much the same.
So it'd be interesting that if we ever get to a place in this world where people look at the number on the scale just like they do phrenology now, this quackery. That would be really interesting. You know, and it's really liberating for people who are attached to their scales to finally realize that it's just this little piece of equipment. You know, it's some plastic and it's some metal and it's some glass. And, you know, it's just a measure of gravity, you know, like how much you're pulling to the earth. And, you know, that it doesn't really say all that much about you. And in my office, we had one time a scale smashing party, and everybody had sledgehammers and safety goggles, and we just smashed those scales up and made sculptures out of them, and you know, just other things.
Nice. So, Kelly, I was thinking, is there ever a reason that someone should have a scale in their home?
You know, yes, from a medical standpoint. There could be some reasons to have a scale in the home. So, for instance, there are some medical conditions where the body will start holding on to water, and you have to be very specific about how many ounces of fluid you can have in a day and how many pounds or half pounds you can let your body go one way or another before there would be a concern and your doctor would have to do something about it. So that would be, somebody who needed to be on diuretics for a medical reason, they might need to weigh themselves. Somebody who has heart issues, like one would be congestive heart failure, and they all of a sudden saw that they were, you know, 10, 15 pounds heavier on the scale, that could be a problem. For older adults, like elderly, we really focus on their weight because older people do lose their appetite. And so we would definitely want to monitor them for changes in weight. Perhaps somebody who had cancer and was going through chemotherapy, we would want to monitor that. So yes, that could, those could all be reasons medically to have a scale in the house. However, you could also probably visit your doctor. You know, all those medical conditions are being monitored frequently enough that the doctor probably could be on top of that. But that would be one. Those would be some reasons I could think of for having a scale in the house.
Okay. Well, I had a friend who recently got a scale, and I was actually pretty reactive about it because I couldn't make sense of why, you know, they got a scale. And they were explaining that for them, they can't really tell when their weight is shifting. And they were concerned about over time, slowly their weight creeping up, and they just wouldn't even notice. And they can easily start to be eating a little bit more every single day, and then again not realizing that they've been eating more and more, and the weight's creeping up slowly over time. And they felt the scale could be a tool to show them when there's been shifts in their weight. And I didn't know what to say to that. I was like, ooh, I guess that makes sense. But I still feel like you shouldn't have a scale.
Because they could also look at their clothes, like you think you would notice mm-hmm. if your clothes were getting tighter.
That's true.
You know, that would be another measure. Some people call that your clothesometer instead of a thermometer, clothesometer. Cool. So, yeah. And then I guess it also would depend on, you know, that person and how healthy their brain was and how they would interpret that information. And if they did see their weight going up, what would they do with that? Would they do something unhealthy mm-hmm. with it or something healthy with it? Mm-hmm. But you also have to be careful because the scale changes from day to day to day. And mm-hmm. so it's just a data point at that point in time. And mm-hmm. so I'll give you some examples of things that could change your weight on the scale. So actually when the barometric pressure changes in the atmosphere, that can change our weight.
Whoa.
So wow. you might see yourself heavier or lighter, and it really has nothing to do with anything that you're doing,
yeah.
but really the atmosphere. If we have a little bit extra salt, we could be retaining water.
Mm-hmm.
And even though that's not real weight, it's going to show up as weight on the scale.
Mm-hmm.
If we are dehydrated, that could change our scale number. If you've been traveling recently and get off of an airplane, mm-hmm. your weight could be drastically different on your scale.
Wow.
If you're constipated and haven't been to the bathroom for a few days, that could change your weight on the scale.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on the time of day you weigh yourself could change. Whether you're having your period or not, or if you have PMS, that could change it.
Mm-hmm.
The time of day, because mm-hmm. if you weigh yourself before you eat anything versus at the end of the day when mm-hmm. you've eaten however many pounds of food and drink however many pounds of liquid, then that could change it.
Mm-hmm.
So there are so many teeny tiny little variables that mm-hmm. can affect your weight on your bathroom scale that I think you would just have to be just very careful
mm-hmm.
that you could interpret all that data and make an informed, mm-hmm. healthy decision about how you're going to behave from that point on.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do weigh yourself, really like weighing yourself on a monthly basis probably would make more sense than definitely weighing yourself on a daily basis, because
mm-hmm.
you'll see so many weight swings.
I see.
You know, once a week would be fine, every other week, okay, probably once a month though would be adequate.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I should have them listen to this episode. See if it makes a difference.
The world according to Kelly.
Yeah. Well, you're well read.
Yeah. So yeah, that's a tough decision.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, all this talk about scales and the pressure that we've been talking about in regards to weighing yourself and numbers and having that ideal body weight, it kind of makes sense that in especially Western society there is this pressure given all of the media attention to diets. We have reality TV that now is all about losing weight. You know,
mm-hmm.
one of the most well-known shows in this regard is The Biggest Loser.
Right, yeah. I mean, people are addicted to that show. And I swear, every time I tell someone I'm a dietitian, they tell me, oh my God, I love Biggest Loser. I just love that show. It's the best show. And I'm always just left a little speechless because, you know, we have pretty strong feelings about
mm-hmm.
it ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's unrealistic and dangerous and definitely perpetuates dieting myths and could lead to eating disorders and is just, everything about it. I can't even watch it. I cannot watch a single episode.
Yeah, I've never actually tried to watch an episode. I mean, I hear about it enough just from different blogs I follow, and it comes up in conversation, you know, with me as well. And it's disturbing because I feel like they're trying to present as a health show
mm-hmm.
and like presenting as if they're coming from a caring place
mm-hmm.
for the participants, but it's so far from that. You know, we were just looking up stuff about The Biggest Loser and some of their contestants and where they are now. There was a couple articles floating around in January this year about what's happened to people after they've been on the show, and just their story of what they went through, the mm-hmm. excessive exercising, the physical health problems they had afterwards, the mental health problems they had afterwards, just working out to a degree that nobody should really be doing.
Right, yeah. And, you know, I just showed you a little clip, and you have never seen that before mm-hmm. in your face. You were just shocked, and you could barely watch it.
Yeah. But I was like, my stomach hurt so bad when we were watching it.
Yeah.
I was just like, it was like watching an eating disorder get created in front of my eyes.
It was. And so, I mean, it starts with shame, you know, and you put these people in small tank tops or sports bras and spandex shorts, and you put them on a scale that's like a cattle scale, and their weight is just, you know, in giant numbers floating up above them. And then throughout the entire thing, I mean, they put them on extremely low calorie diets. They're in a very controlled setting. They have to exercise sometimes 8 hours a day. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't matter if they're injured or sick or exhausted. They have to continue doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of the contestants have later written about the abuse that they endured and how the coaches would use shaming and just negative tactics to get them to follow through with their workouts.
Wow.
And then we just watched a clip at the very end where they have their final weigh-in. And I hadn't seen this before because I don't watch the show either. But the girl came out and they had put an image of her old self. So when they first recorded her in her spandex and top and everything, they had her looking to the side as if she was looking her new skinny self up and down
mm-hmm.
and like making nasty faces at her.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really horrible.
Yeah.
So bad.
Yeah. And
it's
they're planning
not realistic.
All that.
Like these people who, I mean, okay, so yes, it produces weight loss, but number one, is it healthy? And
mm-hmm.
number two, is it sustainable?
Mm-hmm.
And I would pretty much bet that not any of those mm-hmm. people that return home can spend, you know, 8 hours a day exercising, right?
Right.
And they probably also can't be following such a restrictive diet and live any sort of normal life with their family or friends or work,
right?
You know, and so then they gain the weight back. And then what happens? Because now, I mean, anybody that's been on a diet knows that, like, or even my clients with eating disorders, I hear this all the time. Like, I worked so hard to lose this weight, and now I gain this weight back, and everybody's going to notice, and they're going to think I'm a failure, and what are they going to say about me?
Mm-hmm.
And so these people are getting all this positive feedback through the whole show, and then it's over, and they gain the weight back, and then mm-hmm. what do they get?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so shameful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a very vicious cycle. And that, you know, in the material we were reading as well, the personal stories of some of these participants, they were, you know, pressured or pushed or encouraged, I guess, by friends and family to try out for this show. I was just reading that 200,000 people try out for each season. And so, you know, it really is seen as this, you know, solution and a way of getting to health, because, you know, loved ones are probably coming from a really good place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want what they think is best for their loved one, but it's not really the approach to take.
Right.
The other piece with all of this is the profit in it
mm-hmm.
that, and this, I just keep going back to with all this diet stuff, all the diet ads and these shows that on the front that there's like this facade of health, but it's really about a bottom dollar. You know, there's several, you know, just a handful of people that are making a lot of money off of
mm-hmm,
these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's one contestant who wins $250,000.
Right.
But what about the other, you know?
Right. They might need that for their eating disorder treatment.
Yeah, exactly. It'll probably cost that much. Yeah. So, but they're, you know, the rest of them aren't making money from this, but
mm-hmm.
they're getting money made off of their story.
Mm-hmm.
They're making $100 million just off the ads in the show Biggest Loser. And then they're making tens of millions of dollars off the ancillary products. So all like the cookbooks and clothing and mm-hmm. everything that gets sold with the logo on it, and the DVDs with the workouts and all of that. And so, you know, those contestants aren't seeing that money. And I really doubt it's also going to help other people with their health, right? You know, someone's just holding on to that for their own use. So,
well, not only that, but also then the trainers on the show have become famous in their own right. So now they have a brand too, with DVDs and cookbooks and appearances. So it's not just the Biggest Loser brand, it's the brands of the people who are on the show as well. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, I always like to bring this back to eating disorders because we, you know, that's our one of our specialties. And you don't know who's going to develop an eating disorder. We never know that. I mean, and there could be people who are on this show, and yes, they endure the medical consequences and the weight loss and the weight gain, but they might not develop an eating disorder. But then there are people on the show who have developed an eating disorder, and they have come forward with that. And back in 2010, there was a contestant, Kai, who talked about her experience on the show and that she did develop an eating disorder. All the classic symptoms. And so, you know, her hair was falling out, black circles in her eyes, covered in bruises. She lost her period. And when she reached out for help on the show, she just was told to tough it out. That's what she says in her story. And when it got to the point where she was trying to get help, you know, it was a full-blown eating disorder. It would take her an hour just to try to eat a few bites of food because she had so much anxiety about it. So it does happen, and it's really sad.
And I'd imagine there's even some PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, after being a participant on the show as well, with all the verbal abuse and the shaming, that I could see why eating later on would be so challenging. You have that coach or trainer's voice in your head telling you, you know, you're lazy and you're no good. And
And we did an episode before on binge eating disorder, and I don't want to say that all of these people have binge eating disorder that go on The Biggest Loser, but they could have, you know. And if you're not addressing the underlying psychological reasons why you're eating and using food, then you're going to go back to the same problems when it's all said and done.
Maybe even more strongly than when you started.
Okay, well, so we have so much information. I mean, this is obviously a topic that Danielle and I are very passionate about. And so we're going to wrap up here, but then we'll continue on with the same discussion in our next episode. So stay tuned for that in the next couple of weeks.
Great. We do want to have a savor ending. So this week or these next couple of weeks, savor your intuition. You know, there's a lot of messages out there. And again, these ads and testimonials. And if something rubs you the wrong way or doesn't quite sound right, it's too good to be true, it probably is. So really listening to your gut about all these different products and media ads that are out there around diets. So savoring your intuition.